All right, for the sake of time, I'm going to forego any kind of intro. We're going to dig straight in so I can cover as much material as possible during this hour. In our last session yesterday, before the Q&A, we were looking at using the Bill Nye-Ken Ham debate as kind of our skeleton for how we're testing the creation model to see if it is ultimately able to withstand scrutiny. And so I already gave you a debate, an overview of that debate yesterday. This was a few years ago when Bill Nye, the pseudoscience guy, squared off against Ken Ham. And he brought up several interesting points in that debate that Ken Ham did not respond to that I want to look at several of those this morning. And there's other ones that are available in an article I wrote responding to that debate. And they're on the table back there, the free table over on the left, if you'd like to get a copy of that, unless they're all gone, in which case you can go to our website. He brought up the point that how can the biblical model be true if you've got hundreds of thousands of years worth of ice layering in the ice cores of Greenland and Antarctica? How do you have trees that are dated as being older than the flood and even creation in some cases? How can you have civilizations with a history that goes back beyond Babel and even older than the flood, as though they were not wiped out, but they just continued on through the flood? How do you explain that? He said, how do you get, if all the animals are wiped out, all the land animals, how do you get animals to Australia after the flood? How do you have, say, 7,000 species on the ark and get from those that number in 4,000 years to the 16 million on the planet today? That's the equivalent of 11 new species emerging every day since the flood. Number six, how do you even have enough space on the ark for that number of species? And then the seventh one I want to look at in this hour is we have a specific example of a large wooden vessel that was not, it ultimately sank on the open seas due to its tendency for its planks to twist and buckle and ultimately leakage, and it sank. So how could the ark, which is even bigger, have been seaworthy? So let's go ahead and wade through these and look at the actual evidence. So first, the first challenge there is regarding these ice cores in Greenland and Antarctica. So in order to understand a response to that, the first thing you need to know is what ice cores are. This is where scientists will drill down into the polar ice caps and pull up these long cylinders of ice, and notice there's layering in these big cylinders of ice that are annual layers. They accumulate one per year. And so how do we explain that if you've got hundreds of thousands of years worth? How can that fit the biblical model? Well, once again, as with every evolutionary dating technique, they all are founded on the principle of uniformitarianism. The idea being that whatever processes you see going on today, you assume it's been that way throughout time. So if today you don't have conditions that would cause rapid erosion, the rapid accumulation of ice layering and so forth, you assume there never have been conditions that would have done that. But if it is the case that say more than one layer could be deposited in a single year, it would completely destroy the assumption that ice cores can be used in dating. And sure enough, that evidence exists. We know that individual storms and cyclical weather patterns can cause subannual layers that resemble annual layers. And remember, part of the creation model that I laid out for you yesterday involves an ice age that would have been a necessary effect of the biblical flood. And in that ice age, it would have been the perfect conditions for subannual layers to form over several, even hundreds of years there. But modern estimates for ice accumulation in Greenland, for example, are less than 1 foot accumulating per year. But has the estimate been the same throughout time? No. Even in modern times, we have examples of the rapid deposition of ice rather than uniformitarian deposition. For example, in 1988, ground-penetrating radar was used to discover the location of some abandoned World War II planes from 1942 in Greenland. So we know exactly when these planes went down, And surprisingly, the planes had already been buried under more than 260 feet of ice and snow since 1942. So that's over 5 feet of ice forming every year for the 46 years leading up to when they discovered those. So not less than 1 foot per year. So even in modern times, uniformitarian estimates for ice layering and accumulation don't coincide with the actual observable evidence you get out in the field. So Bill Nye's use of ice cores to try to prove an old Earth simply doesn't hold ice under scrutiny. All right, he argued that there are bristlecone pine trees alive today that are as old as 6,800 years, and even a Norway spruce tree called Old Chico that's 9,550 years. Then if so, then these would have had to survive the flood and possibly even precede the creation week. This would be a major problem for the creation model. So how do we respond to that? Well, first of all, to understand response to that, you have to understand something about tree dating. And so you have to understand what dendrochronology is. That is where scientists will study the rings of trees and determine things more than just the age of the tree. You can learn about climate in the past and so forth. You can learn about what was going on in an area of the world based on the nature of these tree rings. But the assumption is that you've got one ring forming every year as that tree is growing. That's what we see happening today. Now, he specifically mentioned old bristlecone pine trees as being 6,000 to 7,000 years old, but you know, first thing you need to do whenever you're dealing with a skeptic is force them to prove their point. You know, let me see the evidence you're talking about. We have to ask, what bristlecone pine tree is he referring to? Because the oldest living bristlecone was discovered in 2012 and dated at 5,062 years old, not 6,800 years. And it was dated using tree ring counting in addition to cross dating. So 5,062 years old, that means it would have started growing around 3,000 BC. So is that a problem for the creation model? Well, potentially, if you have a tree older than when the flood was supposed to occur, the biblical model would place the flood as recent as 2300 BC based on the chronologies of Genesis 11 coupled with history back to Abraham. So we're talking 4,300 years ago, but there is room to expand that number by several years in the chronologies of Genesis 11. And I mentioned yesterday, we've got an article on our website that explains that. So that already eliminates the supposed problem that Bill Nye threw out there. But also consider that once again, uniformity is assumed in the tree ring accumulation. He's assuming one ring forms every year. But again, we know today that rings don't always correlate to single years. Sometimes tree rings can form sub-annually. When you have time staggered, repeated disturbances that are caused by, guess what, unusual weather. That has been shown to severely affect tree ring patterns. So again, whenever you consider the post-flood ice age, which is ensuing during the formative years of the oldest living trees, then that would have caused repeated major storms and atmospheric disturbances. The circumstances would have been perfect for the creation of multiple annual tree rings. So it's very possible that the bristlecone pines are several years younger than they appear. So where did he get 6,800 years as opposed to 5,062? It's unclear. Did he misspeak? Is he actually referring to not living trees, but dead trees that have been cross-dated? That is where dendrochronologists will successively overlap tree ring patterns between trees that are alive and trees that have died, and they'll try to get a history of trees that goes back further. They'll even look at petrified trees and try to correlate rings in that way. As you can imagine, this is a very imprecise and often even very subjective method of trying to get a history of the trees. We have trees alive today in the same forest whose tree ring patterns don't match, because this is a complicated equation that has to do with how far the particular tree is away from water and the direction the sunlight hits it, the soil nutrients, where it is in the forest, the storm patterns and so forth. But they argue, hey, we can get a date back over 8,000 years ago using cross-dating like that, which again, if you've got the flood 4 to 5,500 years ago, that would sound like a problem for the flood model. But notice it's only potentially a problem if you assume that all trees could not have survived the flood. Now the text says all flesh died that moved on the earth. It doesn't mention the plants. Is it possible that there were some areas of the planet that actually had less disturbance? Some trees could have been more robust due to the nature of that pre-flood world we talked about that was clearly a totally different environment. Bert Craig of the Department of Horticulture and Forestry at Michigan State said, we've got many tree species that can survive months underwater during flooding conditions. Horticulturalists Whitlow and Harris produced a monumental work on the effect of flooding on trees and documented dozens of species that are able to survive deep flooding for an entire growing season and even more than a year in some cases. So if trees survive the flood, either because they survived being underwater or because they were brought on the ark with Noah, then trees with over 6,000 rings wouldn't be a problem. And now that said, even if cross-dating could legitimately get you back thousands of years further than the flood and even further than creation, we have to consider another important part of the creation model that we talked about yesterday, and that is the fact that the earth was created mature. It was created with an appearance of age. So remember, Adam and Eve were not zygotes or something. They were already able to tend the garden, understand, communicate, understand God's prohibition. They were able to procreate. Adam was able to carry out biology. You would have starlight already in place at the earth, even from stars that are billions of light years away, in order for that starlight to be used in the way that God indicates there in Genesis 1:14. And so you would expect daughter elements and parent elements in all of your radioactive rocks. And so any kind of radiometric dating techniques that are used to date rocks could immediately show an immediate appearance of age, even in the millions of years, if you have both parent and daughter elements in these rocks when God created them initially. And you would expect tree rings to be present in any of the trees that are on the planet, because the tree rings are necessary to provide strength to the tree as it gets bigger. Otherwise, it's going to fall down. That's more the purpose of the tree rings. It's not to tell us the age of the tree. Each one of those tree rings provides strength to the tree as it matures. So Adam and Eve are already eating fruit from trees. You're going to expect trees to have tree rings on them. So what about the Norway spruce tree, Old Chico, that he mentioned as being 9,550 years old? Well, in the case of Old Chico, it used carbon dating, not dendrochronology. And so this isn't even typically listed among the verified oldest trees on the earth, because C14 is notoriously imprecise and suspect, especially beyond just a few thousand years, caused in large part by its foundational assumptions concerning the effect of the Earth's magnetic field and how that affects the production of C14, the assumption that the ratio of C14 to C12 in the atmosphere has been constant throughout history, which scientists now reject. So archaeologist Brian Fagan of UC Santa Barbara even came out and said, carbon dating is not infallible. In general, single dates should not be trusted. And so tree ages simply can't be used to try to disprove the creation model. Number three, according to Bill Nye, you know, there are human populations that are far older than that, talking about the flood, with traditions that go back farther than that. And so if that's true, that would seem to contradict the biblical text, because again, all civilizations are annihilated at the flood, and only those civilizations that emerge after the flood, and particularly after Babel, should have distinct traditions. Well, again, we have to ask, what civilization is he talking about? He didn't come out and say. We're left to guess and make his argument for him, which you wouldn't actually want to do in a debate. But is he talking about China? Well, they've got records that go back to 1600 BC, and beyond that, it's just uncorroborated legend. So Chinese history can't be said to pose a problem for the creation model. Is he talking about the Sumerians? 2700 BC is the date for the earliest known Sumerian king. The Sumerian language is thought to be the oldest written language and is claimed to go back to 3100 BC. But according to the Encyclopedia Britannica, the chronology of the first half of the third millennium is largely a matter for the intuition of the individual author. Carbon 14 dates are at present too few and far between to be given undue weight. Consequently, the turn of the fourth to third millennium is to be accepted with due caution and reservations as the date of the invention of writing. So the date of 3100 BC is speculative, and even if it's right, it still falls after possible flood date estimates, which can be as high as 3500 BC. What about Egypt? Scholars consider 3100 BC to be the commencement of the first Egyptian dynasty, and again, it can't be known conclusively for the same reason as Sumer, especially due to the inexact nature of tree ring dating, pottery comparisons, carbon dating, and historical records. Some scholars believe that date can be collapsed a few hundred years into the 2000s BC. So either way, all these dates from China, Sumer, Egypt can fit within the biblical model with no problem. So bottom line, his claim doesn't carry any weight here. It doesn't disprove the Bible, but you do notice an interesting pattern here. The oldest living trees date back to about 3100 BC. The Egyptian dynasty goes back to about 3100 BC. The origin of the written language in Sumer goes back to about 3100 BC, with no verifiable civilizations before that time. Guess what? That's exactly what we'd predict if the flood and Babel are true. Something significant seems to have occurred immediately prior to that time period, so I would argue the post-story of the flood is being verified from multiple independent directions. Number four, if there is a flood that wipes out all the animals on the land, how do you get animals to Australia once they leave the ark? You got Australia way out there, away from any continent. Excuse me, I'm having to talk so fast here. Might have some mouth trouble here, but we're moving. We got a lot to cover. So if you've got any animal that's on the continents before the flood, it's going to be wiped out. So how do you get animals out there to Australia from the ark after the flood? Number one, keep in mind, if this is a problem for creationists, guess who it's also a problem for? This is just as much a problem for evolutionists. How do you get animals out to Australia? So evolutionists would be in a fix trying to assert that the animals in Australia evolved completely separately from their own single-celled organism that separately sprang into life hundreds of millions of years ago and eventually evolved into kangaroos, and they don't even argue that. So how do you get out there to Australia, even if you're an evolutionist? Whatever you come up with, why wouldn't the same argument be made by creationists? Number two, while Bill Nye summarily dismisses the idea of a land bridge between Asia and Australia without even considering that, there are actually islands along the path from China to Australia, and the water between those islands can be misleading. It hides what's really going on underneath there. So notice from this map of the Pacific Sea floor that the continental shelf of China actually extends all the way down to the continental shelf of Australia with only a small amount of space between there. So whenever you again consider what the biblical model claims, you're going to have lower waters due to the ice at the poles, then those continents could have been touching or very close to it, making travel from one area to the other more feasible. Another option, remember, we don't have a problem with the idea of Pangaea, the idea that the continents were at one time originally crammed together into a supercontinent. Remember, I showed you in the creation model yesterday that likely all broke apart when the flood began and started moving quickly on the order of meters per second. Remember, Genesis 1:9 may be actually alluding to that idea. If you've got all the water gather into one place, then what does that suggest about the land? It may be implying a supercontinent. So the breakup of the fountains of the great deep, like the ocean floor, suggests the commencement of plate tectonics when the flood began. And as we looked at in one of those sessions, simulations suggest that the movement would have been initially rapid, the plates moving again on the order of meters per second instead of what they are today, centimeters per year. So the continental separation today is about as fast as your fingernails grow. Interestingly, recent research by Yale University geologists provides evidence for the claim that the movement of the continents used to be much faster. In fact, their study showed at least three times as fast as it is today. They said, these observations suggest that either non-uniformitarian plate tectonics, right, so defeating uniformitarianism, or an episode of rapid true polar wander occurred, so we're talking about the poles themselves being adjusted, during the Cambrian explosion of animal life. Notice two things about their study. Number one, it provides evidence that substantiates the creationist theory about the movement of the plates once being much faster. But number two, it highlights the fact that that accelerated movement occurred during the same time as whatever catastrophic event caused the Cambrian explosion. And remember what we talked about yesterday, the Cambrian explosion, what that is in the creation model is the beginning of the flood. Other recent studies also suggest the plates have moved faster in the past. So bottom line, if the continents were together or in much closer immediately after the flood, then getting animals from one continent to another would not be as difficult as it would be today. But there's other options for the creation model as well. It's possible the post-flood ice age would have allowed migration across frozen channels, and we know that that would be the case in certain places. Another plausible option, there would have been no doubt dead pre-flood forests floating on the receding waters of the earth for some time after the flood, which would have made miniature land masses for travel across channels. So, for example, this is a picture from 2012 of Spirit Lake near Mount St. Helens. This is 32 years after the big 1980 eruption, and notice you still have this floating log mat from that catastrophic event. This is an image from The Telegraph, a popular newspaper out of the UK, and the title of the article that contained this picture, notice, is Massive Floating Rubbish Islands from Japan Tsunami Spotted on the Pacific, and this is a shot of that island floating across the Pacific towards the U.S. West Coast. This particular debris island is 69 miles in length. It covered an expanse of 2.2 million square feet. Notice this picture in the description. It explains that members of the Japan Coast Guard found and rescued this dog that was on one of these rubbish islands 3 weeks after the tsunami. It was out there floating on this debris island and survived for 3 weeks. So it's not at all outlandish to suppose that massive debris islands would have been found worldwide after the flood and that animals could have been found floating on those in the years immediately after the flood. And as added evidence of the legitimacy of this theory, recent genetic analysis suggests that the marsupials in Australia, including your kangaroo, originated in South America before they moved to Australia. And so when you look at the projections of what the ocean currents likely would have been during the Paleocene and the Oligocene periods that are immediately after the flood, you see that there would have likely been an ocean current moving straight from South America to Australia. Ocean currents are argued to be how various creatures got from South America to the famous Galapagos Islands that Darwin studied. So even evolutionists use that same argument. So if a tsunami is in one small area of the world could make such a floating island of trees and debris as what was created after the Japan tsunami, then what in the world is a global flood going to do? It's going to create similar, even more substantial islands of debris like those depicted in this painting by Louis Lavoie, who illustrated our Dinosaurs Unleashed book. And of course, one other final possibility as to how you get animals to Australia, humans could have carried them. Now, granted, that's not available for evolutionists. They don't believe humans were on the scene yet, but this is not a problem for the flood model. All right, number five. According to Bill Nye, we got 16 million species on the planet today. There's only 7,000 on the ark. 4,000 years ago, that'd require 11 completely new species emerging every day since the flood. And I've got to admit, when he made that point, I thought, wow, that's a pretty powerful point. How are we going to explain that? And once again, you got to get into the literature and the data to see what's actually going on. He just threw that out there, and he didn't prove it. You got to force these guys to actually prove their claim before you just accept it. So first of all, keep in mind, he is accurate in his representation of at least one thing about the flood model. We don't claim that all current animal varieties, or even necessarily all species, were on the ark. We talked about that some yesterday. Not every variety of dog or even species among the canines would have been on the ark. So species is a modern concept that is defined by humans. We argue what the text says. The different kinds of animals were on the ark, Genesis 6:20. So perhaps a representative of the dog kind from which came your domestic dog breeds that we have today, as well as wolves, foxes, coyotes. There was probably a cat kind, horse kind, elephant kind on the ark, something more like the modern taxonomic category of family or genus. So there's no need to fit every single modern species on the ark, which would be difficult if not impossible, and there's no need to, since many different species within a kind can come about through diversification processes, not Darwinian, but what we call microevolutionary processes. So there would have been representatives from each of these kinds that had the genetic material in them to produce the diversity of creatures that we see today within those kinds. So it's true, from those original fewer species, proto-species on the ark, all current land and creeping thing species would have emerged through some kind of rapid diversification process. Now, Bill Nye threw out there 7,000 proto-species on the ark, and he claimed to be quoting Ken Ham. We don't know if it was 7,000, but creation scientists are studying that question. Could have been more, could have been less. So here's what Bill Nye said. So you'd go out into your yard, you wouldn't just find a different bird, a new bird. You'd find a different kind of bird, a whole new species of bird every day. This would be enormous news. I mean, the last 4,000 years, people would have seen these changes among us. We see no evidence of that. There's no evidence of these species. Notice, by the way, young people, how much he's scoffing at us, and that applies a pressure. It makes you feel like, oh, okay, then maybe I should just back off and not believe. See that pressure that he's applying? When really that's not, don't feel bullied by that. You need to go dig in and look at the literature and see what's actually going on. So whenever he comes out with this 16 million estimate, again, where does he get that for the number of species on the planet? There, you know, that's, again, one of the first things you got to do is force them to prove their point. There's a lot of disagreement over how many species there are today, but that number is extremely high. Some estimates are as low as 2 million, including one estimate that was published by Science Magazine in 2013. One study from 2011 seems well researched and accepted by many scientists, so much so that it was published by the Public Library of Science Biology Division, estimated not 16 million, but 10,960,000. And that estimate included not only the kingdom Animalia, but plantae, fungi, protozoa, chromista, archaea, even bacteria. And keep in mind, these are estimates. The actual catalog number of species on the planet at that time, 2011, was only 1,438,769. They're projecting eventually we're going to find 10,960,000. All right, now also Bill Nye has to be sure to accurately reflect what the Bible claims, what the biblical model would actually suggest. So from this 11 million estimate, we need to subtract marine creatures. Okay, they're not going to have been on the ark. So you remove your ocean-dwelling creatures. That brings you down to 8,750,000. There's possibly other creatures that could have survived in water that could be removed, various amphibians. We'll go ahead and leave them in there for the sake of argument. The plants, the text doesn't mention plants being taken on the ark since they aren't flesh. Genesis 6:19, other than whatever the passengers would have needed to eat. So now you're down under 8.5 million. Incidentally, again, would the plants have died in the flood if they weren't taken on the ark? And no doubt many certainly would have, though not necessarily all of them. In fact, most of the planet's plants are in fact underwater today. But also seeds could have been brought on the ark, and perhaps even more likely, you got to consider all the seeds that would have been available on all those dead plants floating on the waters of the flood. And studies show that seeds can survive being submersed in salt water for extended periods of time. And ironically, Darwin himself conducted one of those studies for evolutionary purposes. Next, you have what are called synonymous species. This is where two names are given to the same species. Creatures originally thought to be two distinct species, they're now considered one and the same, or one creature whose name has changed over time and yet both names were unintentionally counted in the estimates. So the PLOSB paper highlighted this weakness in species estimates, explaining that a survey of 2,938 taxonomists, with expertise across all major domains of life, revealed that synonyms are a major problem at the species level. They believe that 17.9% of all named species could be synonyms, and possibly much more, as much as 46.6%. The World Register of Marine Species documents that 44.5% of all accepted marine species are synonyms. So if we take the lowest estimate of synonymous species for the sake of argument, only 17.9% of the remaining species are synonyms. That brings you down under 7 million now. So notice a far cry from the 16 million that he threw out there, and we're being very conservative. If the flood was 4,500 years ago instead of 4,000, which is closer to our estimate, that brings us down to 4 species a day that come about since the flood, not 11. Now, if there are fewer species than the projections, more synonyms, which is likely, more years since the flood, which is possible, more species that could survive outside the ark, which is almost certain, and more representative kinds on the ark, which is very possible, then that number plummets. And yet we're still not done. Insects, other invertebrates, fungi, bacteria, protozoa, these are all included in the list of 11 million species, even though many of them would not have been on the ark. Invertebrates, for example, make up 95 to 99% of the planet's animal species. Insects alone make up about half of this remaining 6.9 million species. Many of these could have survived outside the ark, significantly reducing the remaining list, though admittedly some creeping things were in fact taken onto the ark, according to Genesis 6:20, since not all of those would have been able to survive the flood. Now, of those that are left, keep in mind that the fast reproduction rates of those insects, for example, on the ark, would have caused rapid speciation immediately after the flood, the rapid diversification of creatures within those created kinds. Flies can lay as many as 100 eggs per day. According to the American Society of Microbiology, one bacterium can produce 10 billion in 10 hours. And so many new species could have been emerging rapidly in the centuries immediately following a flood, and the rate would have then slowed down to a certain extent because of niche conservatism. One study in 1988 published in Science magazine highlighted the correlation between the smaller sized creatures being represented by more species on the planet, providing evidence for this very idea that the smaller creatures that reproduce quicker would be more prone to rapid speciation. So bottom line, 11 new species per day, nowhere near a fair assessment of the data. Even 4 would be a huge overstatement, and most of those would be tiny creatures completely unnoticed by humans, even though Bill Nye scoffingly claimed that such rapid speciation would be noticed by humans. So when we consider that the Earth has a volume of over 1 trillion cubic kilometers, and that humans only inhabit a tiny space on the Earth comparatively, and therefore we're just not in a position to even know what all is going on and in the Earth. The odds that a species would happen to come about in your backyard, much less that it would be large enough for you to even notice it, is essentially zero. But here's the thing, in spite of that, the ironic thing that he apparently didn't realize from the literature is that scientists are still discovering 15,000 new species every year. And guess how many that averages out to every day that scientists are discovering? 41 new species are being discovered every day by scientists that we didn't know were there yesterday. All right, number 6, according to Bill Nye, the National Zoo requires 163 acres to exhibit 400 species. So how could the ark hold 14,000 animals? And again, it's uncertain whether 14,000 would be a good estimate of the representative proto-species on the ark. Let's go with it for the sake of argument. Number one, the ark and the zoo are not a good parallel, are they? The ark wasn't about display for people to come look at them. This is about basic shelter for a period of time. So a better parallel would be, say, factory farm or high-density housing facilities that can take tens of thousands of animals and house them in tight quarters under one roof. Also, number two, if the cubit is 18 inches, as many scholars estimate, so the length from the elbow up to the tip of the middle finger, the ark would have been 450 feet long, so a football field and a half long, 75 feet wide, 45 feet high. Creation geologist and biologist John Woodmerappy did an extensive study on how much space would be required to house not 14,000, but 16,000 animals, and so representatives of each of the genus. And so it's taking into account food, water, waste disposal, heating, ventilation, and lighting, and found that the ark was more than adequate in size to house that number of animals on that size ark. But also consider, what if humans were generally larger in the pre-flood era? As I showed you quotes from evolutionists yesterday that would suggest that humans could have been larger further back in history, and we would say due to better health and life longevity as you move closer to creation. We know that enormous reptiles are living in the past, enormous plants and fruit, remember, which is mentioned in the book of Numbers, as well as enormous humans. So what if the cubit was actually larger than 18 inches, as some estimates actually make it, 20 to 21 inches? So a 25-inch versus an 18-inch cubit actually more than doubles the volume of space on the ark, changing it from 1.5 million cubic feet to 4 million cubic feet. So, of course, we can also reason that the animals would likely not have been full-sized animals. They would have been babies, juveniles, adolescents. Why? Well, smaller animals are going to take up less space. They're going to eat less food, assuming they're not in a hibernative state, and make less waste. And also, younger animals, and this is an important point, younger animals would make it where those animals would survive longer after the flood to help repopulate the planet, which is going to be an important aspect to God. So bottom line, there's enough space for many, many animals. Bill Nye's criticism doesn't disprove the Bible. It really gives it another chance to shine. What about the dinosaurs? Would dinosaurs have been on the ark? We talked about that some yesterday, I think, in the Q&A. Creation scientists know with a high level of confidence where the flood begins in your fossil record, in your geologic column. We think the Cambrian strata begins the flood. The Precambrian would be before the flood. So the line separating them is known as the Great Unconformity, and it goes across the planet separating those strata. So the dinosaur fossils that have been found are all above that line in the flood strata, which suggests they're alive when the flood begins, which means if they're land-dwelling creatures, they would have been represented on the ark. But you keep in mind that the average size of a dinosaur is about the size of an American bison. We tend to think about the big mamas, but the average size of the dinosaur is about the size of an American bison. Remember yesterday I told you that we have a replica of a sauropod dinosaur egg. So the sauropods are the big long neck, long tail, Apatosaurus, Brachiosaurus, Argentinosaurus, Titanosaurus. They start out in a little ball that big. And so even the juvenile big boys would have been able to fit, no problem, on the ark. Or you can always go with something more like this as a potential theory, if you like. Not really. You don't believe that. All right, number seven. He specifically brought up the Wyoming as an example of a large modern wooden vessel that wasn't able to survive on the heavy seas. It sank due to the tendency of its long wooden planks to twist and buckle on the heavy seas. Well, if wooden planks tend to twist and buckle, then wouldn't a larger vessel like the ark be a problem? Well, first of all, as with the ark and a zoo, the Wyoming and the ark are not a good parallel. The Wyoming had six masts and several sails that would have caused immense torsion from the wind filling those sails on the open sea. It would have definitely caused twisting and buckling. I'm surprised that Bill Nye even used this argument as a mechanical engineer. That's silly. The ark, of course, wouldn't have had sails. It didn't need to go anywhere. And so the torsion problem would have been greatly reduced. But also, number two, large ancient wooden ships have been found dating back to immediately after the flood in Egypt. This is one of the technologies you would expect survived the flood, since Noah and his boys would have brought that along with them. And these ships are equipped with a sophisticated interlocking plank system called a mortise and tenon joint. And mortise and tenon joints are known to help prevent twisting and provide added strength to the frame. So clearly, seaworthy, large wooden ships were not out of the question for the ancients. Number three, no one knows what gopher wood was, and God was very specific in choosing this as the wood for the ark. Moses mentioned several other known species of wood in the Pentateuch, including terebinth, green poplar, almond, palm, willow, olive, fig, pomegranate, chestnut, and many other species are mentioned outside of the Pentateuch as well. But God chose this unknown gopher wood, and there really may be no modern equivalent to it when you consider that many of the pre-flood tree species could have gone extinct. And even of those that didn't, They would have all been subject to degeneration from genetic entropy over the years, just like humans and all the animals have gone through. So it's highly unlikely that we even have an equivalent wood today of what was used. Gopher wood was clearly chosen because it was conducive to God's instructions for the ark. Number four, notice that the Wyoming, in spite of its problems, stayed afloat for 15 years, and the ark only needed to stay afloat for a few months. So he did, you know, Bill Nye doesn't show the ark to be unseaworthy. Quite the contrary. Again, it gives us an opportunity to shine even more. And interestingly, the dimensions of the ark have been shown to produce a seaworthy vessel. The SS Great Britain, in service in the 1800s, had a dimension ratio of 332 to 51 to 32, almost exactly that of the ark. In World War II, a group of ships were constructed, nicknamed Ugly Ducklings, and similar to the Ark, these were cargo ships. They were built not for speed or combat, but for just transporting a lot of stuff through the harsh sea. The SS Jeremiah O'Brien, one of those vessels, you can see the feet there, 442 by 57 by 28 feet, and you convert the cubits to feet, and again, this lines up remarkably well with that of the design of the Ark. You also have the most recently designed super jumbo barges, which, like the O'Brien, are a good parallel to the Ark because their purpose is merely to stay afloat while transporting immense amount of cargo. And so these modern barges have a length to width dimension ratio very similar to that of the Ark as well. And then you have the oil tankers, your what they call very large crude oil carriers, the VLCC. So their length to width to height in meters, again, very close to the dimensions of the ark. So you notice a trend. If you want to build a boat that is intended to haul enormous amounts of material across the harsh seas, the best design is to use a length to width to height ratio like that of the ark. So clearly somebody knew what he was doing when designing this vessel. He was no amateur. So Bill Nye brought up some other points that I address in that Reason and Revelation issue responding to this debate. So be sure to grab a copy of that. And we could keep going on. We got other quibbles we could deal with. But the point of this was to show you that the creation model, as I laid it out yesterday, is scientifically defensible. It is a robust model that is able to withstand scrutiny, has great explanatory power to explain the evidence out there. Young people, keep in mind that If you run across quibbles that people bring up to you as you go to college and so forth, first of all, don't ever be intimidated by it. We can already substantiate God exists. The Bible's inspired. This stuff is true. It's just a matter of figuring out what's going on. If you've got questions you can't figure out, be sure to contact us at AP. Email me personally, jeff@apologeticexpress.org, and we can talk about that. You can give me a call anytime you want. If any of you all are looking at doing something like going into science in school, be sure to come do an internship with us over the summer. We'll get you fixed up and prepared for the kind of stuff you're going to deal with when you go to college. So don't ever feel intimidated by the stuff they bring up. There has never been a challenge brought up against the biblical model that has been able to be sustained when you look at the actual evidence, even though they are going to make you feel like an idiot for what you believe. Just don't accept it. What you truly find is they're the ones that are beholden to a mystical, modern, superstitious, mumbo-jumbo belief that it cannot be substantiated by the evidence. It is a modern form of witchcraft without a witch. It's silliness, even though it's the dominant belief. The creation model is the logical conclusion from the evidence. It is the rational one. So never feel intimidated by that. All right, thank you for your attention. In our last session, instead of making the positive case for creation, we're going to make the positive case for becoming a Christian. Thank you.